The Optimist. Conversations with leaders and industries shaping Europe's future. Exploring the ideas and innovations driving progress across the continent.
Hi, everybody. My name's Dale Rickett, and I'm the Managing Director of Tech and host of the Optimist podcast. And we actually managed to catch up live at the Tech with Carlo Ratti. Now, Professor Carlo Ratti is really an institutional name in the area of connected data and smart city. Over the years, he's put together this incredible program at MIT called the MIT Sensible Cities Lab. And what it really does is they use IoT and connected city and sensor technology to make data accessible to all stakeholders in the city environment. So this means users, the citizens, government officers, businesses. What they find is just simply access, this democratic access to data gives them feedback and also the ability to make better decisions and makes the cities themselves interactive. In the discussion which we had on stage, we really cover everything from the framework of how you build up something like this, why democratic data access is important, through to some of the biggest social issues around where technology and AI is leading us and how we have to be careful and become good stewards in the years going forward in this space. Towards the end, Carlo and I look into the future about what his vision for a technological future could be and how we can actually issue this in through good communication, through connecting with each other at events just like the Tech. So I hope you really enjoy this podcast. It was a pleasure to record it live on site at Tech in Heilbronn. And without any further ado, let's jump right on in. Well, welcome everybody. As said, my name's Dale Rickett and I'm the host of the Optimist podcast. It's a real pleasure to have Carlo Ratti here with me today.
Dale, it's great to be here and to be here with all of you. So wonderful day also.
Yes, it's actually funny. We have quite an interesting history together because wherever I go, I seem to meet you on a different stage. It's now, I think, four times that we've been on stage together in different cities. Do you remember each of the occasions?
Yeah, I think it was in Singapore last time, and then before it was New York and London, and now Heilbronn. So onwards and upwards.
And I actually still remember, particularly in New York, you know, we had that amazing experience where we had that glass Bloomberg building, and we had the award ceremony, and you won the Green Tech Award, and that was for your work for the Sensible Cities Lab. Can you tell us a little bit about what you're doing and how it's been developing over those years?
Sure. The Sensible City Lab is part of MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology. We're in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But also now we have a number of global labs, smaller labs. They are in Singapore, in Seoul, in Dubai, in Amsterdam, in Rio, and in Milan. And what we like is really look at cities through the lens of data. Data today can help us to see things we couldn't see just a few years ago. And then through the knowledge, we can then start to think how to design, improve, and ultimately live in better cities.
Fantastic. And with these projects, what does that mean in a concrete way? Which cities do you actually have research labs, living research labs working on?
Yeah, so the places we got the living research lab are the cities I mentioned before, and then we got the main base in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But then also we work in many other cities. And again, through data sometimes coming from citizens, crowdsource data, through data we can get from networks, you know, those are different lenses by which we can understand urbanization in a much better way today than we could just a few years ago.
And what kind of insights do you get, and how does it actually make people's lives better on a daily basis?
Now, you can look at many dimensions. You can look at traffic, for instance. We know that data can give us a sense of mobility in the city, can help us improve it. But we can also look at the human side of cities. So we can look at, for instance, segregation and integration, how we mix in the city. You know something, cities emerged around 10,000 years ago at the very beginning. You know, that's when our ancestors found this beautiful way to bring us together so that together we can be more than each of us individually. And so cities are this kind of magnetic force. That's what the great Lewis Mumford used to say. But at the same time, cities are also places where we segregate, where we separate. You know, ghettos. Ghetto was the name of a neighborhood in Venice called the Ghetto, where Jewish people had to stay during the night. And that's until 200 years ago. And so somehow, you know, this invisible liminal ghettos, as we call them today with my colleague, Richard Sennett, the sociologist, you know, are something we can elucidate, we can look at with data, and through that knowledge, we can hopefully, again, go back to better cities that bring us together.
You know, while you're talking, I had the most kind of abstract thought go through my mind. The CIA has a saying, the truth will set you free. And I feel like data in this case is some time of truth. It helps you break down barriers. Does that resonate with you?
I think, well, you know, data could be very useful. I mean, you need to pay attention because you use a quote and I use another one. It was Disraeli, an old British prime minister, who used to say, you know, there's lies, damn lies, and statistics. So data can also become a lie. It depends how you use it. But yes, data is one way to better understand, for instance, our cities. And then if you do it in the proper way, how we can improve them.
And how do you use or engage with city administrations, with government? Are they open to sharing their data? Are they open to building these kind of, you know, open architectures where people's data can actually be accessed? How does that work from a regulatory point of view?
Yeah, so many, many cities are now opening our data more. We've done beautiful projects in New York already 10 years ago. I remember Mike Bloomberg, when he was mayor of New York, he had a little sign in his office. And that went, in God we trust, everybody else bring data. And what he did as somebody who started a giant company, Bloomberg, based on data. So what he did was, as a mayor, really to make a lot of data accessible for research, for citizens, and so on. And it's incredible. When you do that, then new things happen. In our case, we discover something about mobility that then became, you know, implemented, and I will not get into the details, but somehow, by looking at the data, we discover something about the city that hadn't been seen before.
You know, you've talked about government now. What about the citizens? How are you empowering citizens through the data?
You know, sometimes just the data itself is a way to empower people. I'll give you a quick example. Like a few years ago, we started using AI to analyze Google Street View data in cities around the world. And the first thing we started looking at is trees and classified trees. We call it Treepedia. Imagine having a map of trees in cities globally. And by making that accessible, you'd be surprised. We started being flooded by emails from all over the world. Or people who said, you know, look at my neighborhood. There's not enough trees or less trees in the other neighborhood. I'm going to write to the mayor. Can you help me share the data? And so on. So data itself can be the beginning for taking action.
How do you deal with personal data? Because, you know, you're dealing with completely different regions, different jurisdictions. You've got ProTent in Sao Paulo in Brazil. That's going to have a completely different data structure and regulation to, say, trying to do something in Berlin.
Yeah. So the first thing is that we clearly need to be compliant with local regulations. And the second thing is also we got our own ethical review board, the MIT, looking at that. But I need to tell you something. You know, today I'm very concerned about data. But I'm very concerned about data in our pockets. I'm very concerned about phones. Since you and I woke up this morning, our smartphones probably transmitted thousands of data points. We don't even know where, around the world, in servers, in Silicon Valley, in other parts of the world, collecting a huge amount of information about us. And that's really quite opaque, and the information is getting more and more high resolution, really to the meter level, GPS data, and so on. The urban data usually is not that bad. It's usually something more aggregated, something that looks at the neighborhood. And so data is a very big issue. I think we should all be concerned about it. But the big problem is closer to us in our pocket than in the city.
You know, talking about these aspects of, you know, how we look after our own data, where we share data, for your program, you said it's, of course, reviewed by MIT ethics boards. How does it work in terms of sovereignty? Do you actually host in local regions? Where's the cloud?
Look, that's also a very important thing. Now, when we work in the labs around the world, as I was saying, like in Dubai and so on, we try to keep the data locally. But today, things, you know, clearly then you might have researchers with another university in another country. So somehow then the cloud and that issue is something you always need to look at in great detail.
Okay. And look, beyond the Sensible City Lab, I mean, you're a man of many talents, and I know you invited me last year to do some projects with you at the Venice Biennale. You were the intendant, the leading the Biennale last year. What was that like?
So the Venice Biennale, I was the director of Venice Architecture Biennale last year. The Architecture Biennale is every couple of years. It's kind of one of the main, perhaps the main event in the field of architecture, again in Venice. And what we did last year, we'll look at some of the themes we've been discussing before. So the theme was intelligence, natural artificial collective. We wanted to focus on the fact that today you say intelligence, and there everybody simply thinks, you know, ChatGPT. No, there's much more than that in natural, artificial, and collective, and that has been shaping the built environment and our planet for a very long time. So that was the focus, and then we had architects from all over the world, interdisciplinary teams, architects, scientists, Nobel Prize winners working with young students and so on, really trying to see how we can adapt better to a changing climate and the changing planet.
On this point, I like the idea of natural intelligence. You know, you're talking about nature's systems, the idea that, you know, we're working with information, AI, often, you know, silicon intelligence, if you want to call it intelligence. In the work you're doing now, you're starting to implement AI into your new projects. How do you keep and actually protect the important human aspects, human intelligence, wisdom, these things that we can't yet do with AI?
Look, and also AI, we need to realize it's something very old. You know, people have been using, we've been using this type of networks for a long time. We've been using a lot of deep learning, what I mentioned before, Tripedia, around 10 years ago. That was done using, again, deep learning, which is a different type of AI, different beast from LLMs. But somehow, you know, we don't need to put all of this together. You know, there are different types and has been with us for a long time. And I think the important thing is always to basically have the human component be the one who's in charge, asking questions, and, you know, then it is a beautiful instrument. If you think about deep learning, you teach it, you training with a training set. Usually a training set is produced by humans, is produced by us, and then it's only a way to automate it and do that faster on a massive amount of data. So if you look at that, it's quite simple and quite innocuous. Let me give an example. I'll give an example of a project we published last year. In New York in the 1970s, there was a guy called William Holly White. And Holly White is, for instance, the person who protected Bryant Park. When you go to Bryant Park in New York, you know, just go there and say, thank you, Holly White. And the way he did it, he took a lot of footage, was the first person using Super 8 cameras to take footage of New York and then analyze it to see the beauty of people meeting in public space, how public space was used, you know, how it was really like an accelerator of human interactions. Now, what we did was use the old data, use new data, new footage in the same places, and actually compare the two. And we saw big changes in how we use public space. But the interesting thing is that with AI, we could automate in what would take Holly White months or years of work to analyze frame by frame. Now you can do it in minutes. So AI is just a way to do some repetitive work in that case, that we train it, and then it does it for us much faster.
Now, I'm going to open a new chapter of your life now, because you brought up the issue of speeding things up. You're also the CEO of Carlo Ratti Associati in Turin.
Yeah.
And this is a very, very well-known, established architecture firm, known for its work in sustainable architecture. Are you using AI to assist you in building design now?
It's a very good question. Now, first, let me tell you what AI cannot do, and then I'll tell you what it does and we are using it for, and everybody does. So what it cannot do, again, in these systems, all the time, you've got a training set. In LLMs, the training set is giant. It's a lot of, you know, all the stuff that humanity has been writing and so on. And then you train it, and then these things becomes one of my best definitions, which is not mine, is by actually a great computer scientist, is these are stochastic parrots. So basically, you train it, and then when you ask something, it can repeat that in a stochastic way. Sometimes it tells you it's this or that, a bit, sometimes it hallucinates. But, you know, it is very good to absorb a lot of data and as a parrot, repeat some of them like that. Now, what it cannot do is actually do something new. You can use it, and many architects use it, in order to do text to image, which means you say, I want to do a house on a waterfall in the forest. And this thing will take frankly dried house and a bit of other things and do synthetic thing. They mix together like a parrot that mimic what is in the training set of humanity, you could say. But what you'll never do, and it's the most beautiful and human thing, is doing what has never been done. You know, if you train it in before Frank Lloyd Wright did Falling Water, then that thing would never develop that. It was a new paradigm of how you can think about a house in nature and so on. So somehow what it leaves us, we can use it at the beginning to get inspiration about the past, but it will never be able to imagine what hasn't been there yet, what is not in the training set.
It's fascinating. And a parallel in my life, I lecture at University of Amsterdam. I supervise master's students, and more than half of them use AI to write their theses. You can just feel it when you start reading their theses. And the thing is, what you get from an AI system writing, it's perfect crap. Do you know what I mean? Like, it's just, it goes for pages but says almost nothing. And this is, I think, what you mean, because there's nothing new.
Well, you can also say, you know, if you ask something that, you know, let me give you, I agree with you, but with a little difference in flavor. Let me give you an example. So last year with the Venice Biennale, I was getting plenty of interview requests. And so my communication team trained what they started calling Carlo GPT. So they think that all the previous interviews I'd done, you know, they put all the books and all the stuff or the articles, and then this thing was replying to questions. And then for every question that I had taken before, that was perfect. Was taking my words, you know, maybe different answers, but crafting something meaningful. Every time there was a question that wasn't there in the set, it would hallucinate. So I think, you know, it can do well if it is something related to the training. And, you know, I don't know how the students use it, maybe, but yes, if you have something that's not in the training or not exactly in that, then it's, as you say, beautiful crap. Your words.
It's my Australianisms, you know. Great. Look, I want to get to a personal side now. We've got a couple of minutes left. You're one of these rare breeds of Europeans. You're living between Boston and Turin and all the other places, Singapore, that you go to. Do you still feel European?
Look, I think the past couple of years have made all of us, and me in particular, feel more and more European with what is happening on the planet. I also, the other thing, you know, yes, it's not that I commute. I try to travel much more slowly these days. You know, post-COVID, we can spend more time and connect remotely and so on. So that's another good thing. So I can spend more time. It's not about before COVID, it was everybody was traveling much faster. I think now you can really go to a region and spend a bit of time and then go back and so on.
Great. And for my last question, with the Optimist podcast, that's the name of the show we're here as a part of this. And these are dark times we're living in. We have, you mentioned, there's wars on Europe's doorstep. We've got geopolitical tensions, trust is being undermined. How do you keep hope and what keeps you hopeful?
Maybe a quote by the great Karl Popper, the Austrian British philosopher. And Karl Popper said, you cannot predict the future. He says the future is open, it's not predetermined, and thus it cannot be predicted. But then the future will depend on all of us. So in that openness, that's our time for action. Maybe starting today, somebody with a great idea who can actually change the course of things. So I think that certainly is a reason to be optimistic.
Fantastic. If anything, quote, thanks so much. Multiple futures, choose the positive one, create your own future. Thanks so much, Carlo
Ratti. Thank you, Dan.
And next time we'll meet in Madrid, I think.
And thanks, everybody.
Thanks very much. That was me speaking live to Professor Carlo Ratti at Tech in Heilbronn just a couple of weeks ago. And actually, with that live session recorded on site at Tech, that's the end of season 2 of The Optimist. And it's been a real pleasure guiding you through these various topics. We've covered sovereignty, we've covered industrial data structures, we've covered a lot on AI and how we bring AI with good governance. But the journey goes on. So after the summer holidays, we'll be starting with season 3. We've already got a bunch of fantastic, exciting guests lined up. So don't miss being a part of the journey. Stay listening. If you have ideas, if you want to reach out to us, do so via our community hub. Otherwise, you can also send us an email at any time. We look forward to engagement, and we look forward to seeing you after the summer for season 3 of The Optimist. Thanks very much. I'm Dale Rickett, Managing Director of Tech, and look forward to seeing you then.
Thanks for listening to The Optimist. For more insights and updates about tech, visit us at tech-europe.org. The Optimist is produced by Tech by Handelsblatt. Music by Christian Heinemann. Stay curious.